Rushdoony Radio presents Systematic Theology in Two Volumes by Roussus John Rushdoony, narrated by Nathan F. Conkey, produced with permission by the Chalcedon Foundation. 2. Infallibility and Immanence. The concept of infallibility, when denied to God and His Word, does not disappear. Instead, it is transferred to another area. Historically, as Christendom turned to Aristotle and to natural law, the concept of infallibility came into a new prominence as church, state, and school claimed it for themselves. Within the church, it developed into the doctrine of papal infallibility and, in some cases, the divine right of presbytery and like concepts. Although the doctrine had deep roots in scholasticism and the medieval church, it was not formally defined until the First Vatican Council in 1870. We, adhering faithfully to the tradition received from the beginning of the Christian faith, with a view to the glory of our divine Saviour, the exaltation of the Catholic religion, and the safety of Christian peoples, the Sacred Council approving, teach and define as a dogma, divinely revealed that the Roman pontiff, when he speaks ex cathedra, that is, when fulfilling the office of pastor and teacher of all Christians, on his supreme apostolical authority, he defines a doctrine concerning faith or morals to be held by the universal church. Through the divine assistance promised him in Blessed Peter, is endowed with that infallibility with which the divine Redeemer has willed that his church, in defining doctrine concerning faith or morals, should be equipped, and therefore that such definitions of the Roman pontiff of themselves, and not by virtue of the consent of the church, are irreformable. If anyone shall presume, which God forbid, to contradict this our definition, let him be anathema. End quote. This statement has been cited not only to illustrate the development of a non-biblical doctrine of infallibility, but also to call attention to the fact that it is the most modest of all such claims in the modern world. Men have given undue attention to this papal authority as an example of an obsolete and authoritarian belief in the supposedly rational and scientific climate of a modern era. In this, they have simply revealed their own hostility to the church. Without giving assent to this dogma of papal infallibility, let us analyse its relative modesty. P.J. Tenner has commented on the meaning of the dogma. Quote, "For the correct understanding of this definition, it is to be noted, in the first place, that what is claimed for the Pope is infallibility merely, not impeccability or inspiration. In the next place, the infallibility claimed for the Pope is the same in its nature, scope, and extent as that which the Church as a whole possesses. Nor does his ex cathedra teaching, in order to be infallible, require to be ratified by the Church's consent. The Pope teaching ex cathedra is an independent organ of infallibility. In the third place, infallibility is not attributed to every doctrinal act of the Pope, but only to his ex cathedra teaching, and the conditions required for ex cathedra teaching are mentioned in the Vatican Decree. A. The pontiff must teach in his public and official capacity as a theologian, preacher, or allocutionist, not in his capacity as a temporal prince or as a mere ordinary of the Diocese of Rome. It must be clear that he speaks as spiritual head of the Church Universal. B. Then it is only when, in this capacity, he teaches some doctrine of faith or morals that he is infallible. C. Further, it must be sufficiently evident that he intends to teach with all the fullness and finality of his supreme apostolic authority. In other words, that he wishes to determine some point of doctrine in an absolutely final and irrevocable way, or to defend it in the technical sense. These are well-organized formulae by means of which the defining intention may be manifested. D. Finally, for an ex cathedra decision, it must be clear that the Pope intends to bind the whole Church to demand internal assent from all the faithful to his teaching under pain of incurring spiritual shipwreck, naufragium fide, according to the expression used by Pius IX in defining the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin. End quote. There are thus some limitations on papal infallibility, as Father James F. Wathen has pointed out. Quote, whereas the Supreme Pontiff's authority is coextensive with his jurisdiction, his infallibility is not. End quote. However, the infallibility of the Church flows out of papal infallibility in Roman Catholic doctrine. Quote, the Church, as the source and cause of salvation, stands on the papacy as a building stands on its foundation. Its imperishability derives from the papacy, from the infallibility of the papacy. End quote. And the same is true of the Church's infallibility. On the other hand, quote, our notion of infallibility should include only what we are required to believe and nothing else. End quote. Wathen's arguments, as he then develops them, would be disputed by some Roman Catholic theologians, but that fact illustrates the problem. The doctrine of papal infallibility is a limited doctrine in its meaning and is open to debate. Thus, while not agreeing with the most conspicuous example of a modern doctrine of infallibility, we must all the same call attention to its limitations. These limitations exist because the doctrine is, to a large extent, tied not only to a tradition, but to an historic faith and a supernatural revelation. The restrictions imposed by that history and revelation are severe ones. When we come to the doctrine of the infallibility of the state, the restrictions quickly disappear. The doctrine of the divine right of kings appeared when Christian doctrine still imposed some hesitation on royalist philosophy, but the claims were still very extravagant. Hume has called attention to the practical application of the doctrine in the reign of Elizabeth I of England, and Parliament protested the granting of various economic monopolies to men favoured by the Crown. Quote, these grievances, the most intolerable for the present, and the most pernicious in their consequences that ever were known in any age or under any government, had been mentioned in the last Parliament, and a petition had even been presented to the Queen, complaining of the patents, but she still persisted in defending her monopolists against her people. A bill was now introduced into the lower house, abolishing all these monopolies, and as the former application had been unsuccessful, a law was insisted on as the only certain expedient for correcting these abuses. The courtiers, on the other hand, maintained that this matter regarded the prerogative, and that the commons should never hope for success if they did not make application in the most humble and respectful manner to the Queen's goodness and beneficence. The topics which were advanced in the House and which came equally from the courtiers and the country gentlemen and were admitted by both will appear the most extraordinary to such as are prepossessed with an idea of the privileges enjoyed by the people during that age and of the liberty possessed under the administration of Elizabeth. It was asserting that the Queen inherited both an enlarging and restraining power by her prerogative. She might set at liberty what was restrained by statute or otherwise, and by her prerogative she might restrain what was otherwise at liberty, that the royal prerogative was not to be canvassed, nor disputed, nor examined, and did not even admit of any limitation, that absolute princes, such as the sovereigns of England, were a species of divinity, that it was in vain to attempt tying the Queen's hands by laws or statutes, since, by means of her dispensing power, she could loosen herself at pleasure, and that even if a clause should be annexed to a statute, excluding her dispensing power, she could first dispense with that clause, and then with the statute. After all this discourse, more worthy of a Turkish divan than of an English House of Commons, according to our present idea of this assembly, the Queen, who perceived how odious monopolies had become, and what heats were likely to arise, sent for the Speaker, and desired him to acquaint the house that she would immediately cancel the most grievous and oppressive of these patents. The house was struck with astonishment and admiration and gratitude at this extraordinary instance of the Queen's goodness and condescension. A member said, with tears in his eyes, that if a sentence of everlasting happiness had been pronounced in his favour, he could not have felt more joy than that with which he was at present overwhelmed. Another observed that this message from the sacred person of the Queen was a kind of gospel or glad tidings, and ought to be received as such, and be written in the tablets of their hearts. And it was further remarked that in the same manner as the Deity would not give his glory to another, so the Queen herself was the only agent in their present prosperity and happiness. The House voted that the Speaker, with a committee, should ask permission to wait on Her Majesty and return thanks to her for her gracious concessions to her people. End quote. The kings of England were, quote, a species of divinity, even though not always sane nor housebroken. Cromwell, who recognised the popular faith in kings, dismissed a proposal to place Charles Stuart, later Charles II, on the throne, saying, quote, he is so damnably debauched he would undo us all. Give him a shoulder of mutton and a whore, that's all he cares for. End quote. Yet, after Cromwell's death, when Charles II was placed on the throne, a trial of, quote, the regicides, end quote, was held. The court refused to consider the case against Charles I as a traitor to the people of England in terms of the original feudal character of the throne. Instead, the modern doctrine of the divine right of kings was used to rule any and every act against the crown as morally, religiously, and legally wrong. This was clear in the opening remarks of Sir Orlando Bridgeman, Chief Baron of the Exchequer and presiding judge. Quote, the trial opened on Tuesday, October the 9th, 1660, with the presiding judges charged to the jury. Bridgeman traced the legal position of the monarchy from the earliest times, showing that no single person or community of persons has any coercive power over the King of England, that the King was supreme governor, subject to none but God, and could do no wrong, and that if he could do no wrong, he could not be punished for any wrong. End quote. Related to this idea of the King's divinity was the belief in the healing power of, quote, the King's touch, end quote. After 1688, this concept of divine right was transferred to Parliament. Even as Bridgeman held that Charles I could, quote, do no wrong, end quote, so in 1946 the Attorney General of England, Sir Hartley Shawcross, MP, declared, quote, Parliament is sovereign. It may make any laws. It could ordain that all blue-eyed babies be destroyed at birth, end quote. This is an explicit assertion of Parliament's sovereignty. It is also implicitly an assertion of infallibility, since it recognises no sovereign power or law beyond Parliament. In the Soviet Union, the issue of infallibility came to the fore in the aftermath of Khrushchev's speech of February the 25th, 1956, attacking the work of Stalin. This step gained the new ruler some popularity, but it raised serious questions with respect to the Marxist faith in the infallible working of the dictatorship of the proletariat as a manifestation of historical process. Second thoughts, prompted by Chinese communist critics, led to some serious misgivings. Quote, if even an, quote, outstanding Marxist-Leninist, end quote, the leader of the party, can become a victim of these contradictions, then surely all other leaders of the party may become similarly divorced from the actual conditions of society. And is it not possible then for the party and the government to become isolated from the people? These questions were not answered in the 5th of April edition, but they were answered later, and the answer was yes, indeed it was possible, but such an answer struck at the foundation of Orthodox communist theory itself, which held that no such possibility could ever occur. The party, at least, was infallible in its knowledge of the historical process. As a result, there was some backtracking, and in his 1957 speech on the 40th anniversary of the October Revolution, Khrushchev resorted Stalin to his, quote, due place as a dedicated Marxist-Leninist and stalwart revolutionary. Our party and the Soviet people will remember Stalin and pay tribute to him, end quote. In every modern state, in varying degrees, there is a working doctrine of the infallibility of the state. There is a hesitancy about an open formulation of the concept, but it is nonetheless present. Those who hold to democracy, to the belief that the voice of the people is the voice of God, vox populi, vox Dei, look to the people's voices in its lowest expression, end quote, the masses, end quote, in minority groups, prisoners, perverts, and others who are held to be representatives of, quote, the people, end quote, rather than of, quote, vested interests. Talman has cited the opinions of Mazzini and others to illustrate the belief in the infallibility of the people. Quote, the Spirit of God can only descend upon the gathered multitudes. It is for them to say what they believe or do not believe. End quote. Quote, we believe in the infallibility of the people, end quote, but, quote, we put no trust in men, end quote. Only the totality of the individual people is God's church. Rulers, party leaders, parties themselves may err. Quote, the mass can never err, end quote. Individuals may often seduce and exercise an evil influence on the masses, but they can never, in the last resort, completely deprave or stifle man's conscience. Sooner or later, the real good nature of the people reasserts itself, and the men of conscience, quote, are in the majority, and that majority has always the superiority of a purer sentiment, of better sense, of a calmer conscience, end quote. Over those who separate themselves, quote, from the people, end quote, end quote. After Rousseau, the belief in the infallibility of the people also meant the infallibility of an elite who can incarnate the general will of democratic society. This elite can know the democratic consensus better than the ballot box, and thus are the supposed expression of the infallibility of the social order. This was the belief of the leaders of the French Revolution. Quote, it was to be a committee of the most faithful and most ruthless. This was the conception underlying the regime of the Committee of Public Safety and Jacobin dictatorship, a regime designed to make the revolutionary purpose triumph at all costs and not to realize liberty in the sense of free self-expression, a system which replaced the principle of popular choice by the principle of the infallibility of the enlightened few in the central body, acting in a dictatorial manner through special agents appointed by themselves, end quote. It should be noted that such non-Christian scholars do not hesitate to use the word infallibility in describing the authority of the modern state and its ruling elite. A prerogative of God has been appropriated by the state. Moreover, the state, like God, increasingly claims total jurisdiction over every area of life and an omnicompetence in every sphere. The state has become the new agency in whom man lives and moves and has his being. Compare Acts 17:28. Man now addresses his prayers and petitions to the state, which he believes to be his hope of salvation. The school, no less than the state, lays claim to infallibility. An infallible organ is beyond criticism. Christians hold the Bible to be its own interpreter and thus its own standard. It is the characteristic of an infallible organ or agency that it is free from external constraint, criticism, or judgment. All of these aspects of the doctrine have been incorporated into the dogma of academic freedom. This dogma had its origins in the, quote, medieval, end quote, era, and has since been greatly expanded. The academy, it is held, is beyond criticism by any standard extraneous to itself. Teachers and professors are ostensibly free to teach whatever they choose, in contempt of the trustees of the school. because their profession gives them immunity. The clergy's immunity before the civil courts in earlier centuries was a very limited one. The new clergy of the schools claims total immunity from all jurisdictions, even in the face of the most ridiculous performances. Thus, in a Cranston, Rhode Island high school in 1972, a teacher of, quote, an innovative social studies program called Economics and Politics in the Community, end quote, George O'Neill, invited a prostitute, quote, to speak with, end quote, his 40 pupils. In the uproar that followed, quote, a teacher who asked not to be identified said that 99% of the faculty and most of the pupils who understand the situation support O'Neill. It's a question of academic freedom, end quote. The teacher can do no wrong, clearly. Examine again the claims made in Parliament for Elizabeth I that her, quote, prerogative was not to be canvassed, nor disputed, nor examined, and did not even admit of any limitation, end quote. Is not this the thesis of, quote, academic freedom, end quote? A teacher can strip herself naked in a sex education class. It is academic freedom. A professor can incite students to revolutionary violence. It is academic freedom. By virtue of their teaching office, such people are supposedly beyond criticism, and their every absurdity has some esoteric and infallible meaning which vindicates them always. Infallibility is not an obsolete doctrine. It is very much with us. It has simply been transferred from the Word of God to the Word and institutions of man. Well done for listening all the way to the end. This is Nathan, the narrator, speaking to you from Puebla, Mexico, from the Faith for All of Life school in which I teach English as a volunteer. I teach from kinder through high school. Now, I rely on donations in order to keep teaching and recording, so if you want to support a Faith for All of Life school in Latin America and want to keep listening to Rush Dooney while you vacuum, drive or cook, commute or whatever you're doing right now, donate at ctn.org/Nathan Conkey. That's NathanConkey, all lowercase. Or if you prefer PayPal, paypal.me/N Nathan, capital C Conkey. You can also email me at nfconkey, that's nfconkey@gmail.com. Thanks, and I look forward to speaking to you very soon.